From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Barry is the name of the first tropical storm of the Atlantic hurricane season this year. It is in the Gulf of Mexico and is due to hit Louisiana this weekend, possibly as a hurricane. Meanwhile, parts of New Orleans are already flooding. Joining us now is Patrick Madden, regional news director at WWNO in New Orleans and WRFK in Baton Rouge. He's in New Orleans right now. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And we've seen the images of the flooding that's already happening. Give us a sense of what you're seeing there in New Orleans in terms of flooding before the storm.
Right. So actually, thankfully, right now, I mean, it's sunny and blue skies, and all of that water we got yesterday during that rainstorm has gone away. It has drained. So right now, thankfully, the streets are clear. But I mean, as you saw, if you've seen some of the images yesterday of people on kayaks and whatnot, I mean, it was flooded and it happened so quickly because we got about 8 inches of rain in less than an hour. And so, and this isn't even the storm that's coming. This was just a taste of it. You know, one of the outer band storms just coming our way.
Well, and we know that ceaseless rain, that's what the National Hurricane Center is warning about, is going to be one of the biggest worries in the coming days. What are you expecting from Barry?
Right. So the rain is the worry, but the real reason it's a worry is because of the water level of the Mississippi River. It's unusually high right now here around us. It's about 16 feet high. And so, you know, the levees around us are you know, roughly 20 feet high. And so forecasters are calling for, you know, 3 feet of storm surge. So, you know, when you add those numbers up, the water level from the storm surge is going to be at or around where these levees are. So there's a real concern about overtopping. And now, you know, officials, Army Corps folks are saying they don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, residents here are understandably concerned about this, and especially in some of the lower-lying areas where the levees aren't as high, there is concern that, you know, there could be overtopping.
And these levees are levees that were reinforced to the tune of something like $16 billion after Hurricane Katrina, right?
That's right. But I think the levees we're talking about here are going to be more from the river. Mm-hmm. So that's why this is such a concern. But, you know, after Katrina, obviously, there's always going to be anxiety about the integrity of these levees. And again, the Army Corps says they're confident in the integrity of these levees, and they're adding additional protection in certain areas where they think there could be issues. But again, sort of outside New Orleans and some of the lower-lying areas, I think there's a lot of concern there as well.
And what about the pumps in the city? Are they working as they should?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. So yesterday, we had this huge rainstorm, 8 inches, less than an hour, and I was in my car, and suddenly I was stuck for 3 hours because there was, you know, waist-high water all around us. And the pumps did work yesterday, but it took a long time for that water to recede. So, and as the head of the Water and Sewerage Board told us, I mean, look, any system that sees that much rain is going to get overwhelmed. So the pumps appear to be working, but it's an old system. And anytime you have a lot of water, especially here in New Orleans, you know, there's a likely possibility that the flooding is going to be a major issue.
Now, the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, declared a state of emergency for storm impacts yesterday. How else are officials there responding so far?
So I'd say, you know, in New Orleans proper, here in Orleans Parish, right now, we have a sort of shelter in place is the message from officials. In some of the other areas, they are actually doing or calling for mandatory evacuations in places like parts of Jefferson Parish, Plankman. So there are other areas that are already getting calls for evacuations. But here in New Orleans proper, that hasn't happened yet. But again, across the state, we're seeing a lot of the National Guard mobilizing. Mm-hmm. Some of these sort of high water vehicles are being set up around. So I'd say it's just, you know, an all hands on deck right now across the coastal part of the state.
Well, and what about residents? Are people leaving? Are they going to stay in New Orleans during this storm? Are they loading up on supplies?
Definitely loading up on supplies. I mean, I've heard from just colleagues here at the station, you know, going into a grocery store and it was out of water. And I know there's also, you know, folks are filling up their gas tanks, getting groceries. Mm-hmm. So I think the most part, from what I'm hearing, is people are gonna stay here and stick this out. But again, this could take a while. I mean, we're hearing this storm could be with us until Monday.
That is Patrick Madden, who is regional news director at WWNO in New Orleans and WRFK in Baton Rouge, talking about Tropical Storm Barry, the first of the Atlantic hurricane season this year. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thank you, Jeremy.
To Washington now, where conservatives and right-wing provocateurs who say they've been secretly censored by online giants like Google and Facebook are meeting with President Trump today for what the White House is calling a social media summit, even though none of those social media giants like Facebook or Google or Twitter will be there. Ina Fried is chief technology correspondent for Axios. Hi, Ina.
Hi, Robin.
So we know some of the people who will be there. There's James O'Keefe, the founder of Project Veritas, who's made his name secretly recording videos of subjects he wants to expose as biased. Who else might be there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a range of folks that are basically in the president's camp. You know, these are people who support him online, who have supported causes that are sympathetic to him and that he's supported causes sympathetic to them. So basically, you know, it's a friendly gathering for the president, and it's also, you know, a chance for them to vent fairly privately about whatever it is they feel like the tech industry isn't doing for them.
Well, none of them, as I understand it, have been banned. Many have been. Alex Jones of InfoWars has been banned, and not just hate mongering, but, you know, complete falsehoods. But these people haven't been banned. What is their complaint?
I mean, I think there's a couple different concerns that have been voiced, especially by the president. One is losing followers. And part of that is that the platforms, especially Twitter, are trying to cull down the number of bots, the number of not real people that have accounts on the service. So anyone with a lot of Twitter followers is going to see this. Trump has millions, so he's going to see it more than some in absolute numbers. But, you know, I have a decent number, and my follower count sometimes goes down. It's not a sign that Twitter hates me. It's just a sign that not everyone that follows me is a real person.
Right.
And so that's one concern that comes up. The other is what the right likes to call shadow banning, but is really the sites enforcing their standards and saying, you know what, if a tweet or a post is not so bad that it needs to be banned, it doesn't violate the rules, but it's not healthy to our conversation, it's choosing to promote it less. And this is probably the strongest tactic that the platforms are growing to recognize they can use to make their platforms a better place. But if you trade in conspiracy theories or racism or white supremacy, you may find your posts less prevalent. And that's something that some of these folks don't like.
Well, it's interesting that the president, you know, is so outraged at the social media giants. He has said that Google, he thinks, is trying to rig the next election, which, of course, you know, Google was a victim of Russian bots in favor of then-candidate Trump. He's complained, as you just said, about what he's perceived as Twitter blocking some of his followers. Twitter says they're just getting rid of bots. But the president has wanted to block people himself. And this week, a federal judge ruled that he can't block critics from his Twitter feed. You know, what is the White House saying about having a summit that is labeled as a social media summit, but the only people invited are supporters of the president?
I mean, they're not saying much. This is, you know, what they've been doing. They had this thing on the website, you know, have you seen bias? You know, report it to us. This has been the modus operandi of, you know, trying to say, we see conservative bias. If you see anti-conservative bias, come join us. This is the latest step in that. I don't think this is a summit in the traditional sense of the word, and I don't think it's really a discussion of the broader issues around social media. I think it's a collection of like-minded individuals gathering to share the grievances that they share as a group.
Well, there's a cautionary tale for anyone wanting to get too close to social media because there's so much disinformation. The Washington Post reporting that just this Monday, the president retweeted a 2017 meme that falsely attributed to President Ronald Reagan a quote that was complimentary of Donald Trump. That is not true. It's been flagged as false. He retweeted it. He invited, if I understand this correctly, he's invited some of these meme creators into the Oval Office prior to the summit today. the guy who created the Time magazine cover that suggested Trump would stay in office forever. President Trump retweeted that, but the same person who made that meme also posted that video that showed Trump slapping and shooting a gun at CNN's Jim Acosta, and that creator's account was suspended for 8 days. Is the White House, have they expressed any concern that by mind-melding with these people today, whatever they do in the future, the White House will seem to have endorsed?
This is a tacit endorsement of these folks by inviting them in. And I think, you know, these are folks that Donald Trump wants to be part of his 2020 reelection effort. I see this as much as a campaign event as a, you know, White House exploration of technology.
Yeah. That's Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios. Ina, thank you.
Thanks.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from EmberWave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. EmberWave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, own your temperature.
There is relative peace in Sudan for the moment. The country's military rulers and a pro-democracy coalition have had a power-sharing agreement in place since last week. The agreement follows the removal of Sudan's longtime president in April, a military takeover, and then a brutal crackdown on the pro-democracy movement that saw more than 100 people killed in June. Joining us now is Alex Duvall, who is executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's in London. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's a pleasure.
And what do you make of this moment in Sudan's history?
In the big picture, it's a remarkable moment. What we've seen is one of the best organized, extraordinarily disciplined, broad-based popular uprising, scrupulously nonviolent, that brought down a 30-year-old dictatorship. And that is tremendous. In the immediate focus, the power-sharing agreement that was reached in outline on July the 5th mm-hmm. between the Transitional Military Council and its leader, General Hemeti, and the Alliance of the Forces for Democracy and Change, Freedom and Change, the democratic protesters. That is a step forward, a necessary step that de-escalates tension, but it doesn't really address some core issues that are going to arise in the short and medium term.
And what are those issues?
Well, in the short term, the reason why the deal was signed was that extreme pressure was exerted on the backers of the Transitional Military Council. That's an Arab troika of countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, the latter two providing most of the funding to keep the Sudanese state afloat. And none of these three countries like democracy. In fact, they're all fairly hostile to the type of democratic uprising that we've seen in Sudan, and were quite happy to see it repressed. But the U.S. and the United Kingdom put a lot of pressure on these countries, saying your reputation is at risk. Your reputations are already damaged by the war in Yemen and other events like the murder of Kamal Khashoggi. And so they said, you don't want to get branded with being behind the repression of democracy mm-hmm. in Sudan. So come to an agreement with the protesters. And what's in it for you? We're not going to press for accountability for the crimes committed during that crackdown. And they also pressed the democracy and freedom and change protesters to say, you really need to come to the table. You've got a strong hand on the streets, but you've made mistakes. You had opportunities for bringing in others in the opposition, including the armed groups that are still fighting in Darfur and mm-hmm. other places. You didn't bring them in, so you need to compromise too.
But then I'm thinking about this table with all of these players at it now with this power sharing agreement, and to have five people from the military and five people from the pro-democracy movement. won't the military have the upper hand in those discussions about what happens next?
The military have the upper hand not only because they will have the chairmanship of this sovereign council for the first year and a half, and therefore they will have the votes, but more fundamentally, if we scrape away the surface negotiations and look at what's really going on, where is the money? Where is the coercive force? What we see is a very different landscape, because two things have really happened that are fundamentally important in Sudan in the last few years that caused the overthrow of President Bashir and the ascendancy of this leader, General Mohamed Hamdan, known as Hemeti. Now, Hemeti is not a conventional military figure. In fact, he's a paramilitary figure. And he's the power of the day in Khartoum. And he's the power of the day because his paramilitaries are there on the streets. The army are not actually on the streets. And because the chief source of hard currency, real finance in Sudan is a combination of gold and the income from renting out troops to fight in Yemen. They also just struck a deal to rent them out to fight in Libya on behalf of the Egyptians and the Emiratis. Now, any technocratic leader, any minister of finance or prime minister who comes in, number one job is fix the economic crisis in Sudan. The country is going down the tubes with hyperinflation, with constant devaluation on the black market. Now, in order to do that, you actually have to take on the fact that Hemeti's economic power, his economic muscle, the fact that he's able to dominate the political scene comes from the fact that he controls gold and the flow of income from this Arab troika of countries. And so there's no betting really on who would win a confrontation between a IMF and World Bank groomed technocratic minister in his suit and this hard scrabble street fighter with his paramilitaries who controls the real money. Hemeti will win. And so that is the problem that really needs to be fixed in Sudan, and it'll need a lot more than just signatures on a power-sharing agreement.
Do you think that there will be free and fair elections in a few years, as is being promised?
In order to get to those elections, that the power of this sort of secret cabal of military leaders and their backers in the Arab world needs to be broken. Otherwise, the country will actually face exactly the same crisis that brought down the former president, Omar al-Bashir. People will come out on the streets because their hyperinflation is destroying their livelihoods. And unlike the military, the regular military, who have shown considerable restraint, the paramilitaries, the so-called rapid support force commanded by General Hemeti, they don't have much in the way of restraint. So the same crisis will recur, certainly within those 3 years. And addressing that crisis is the truly urgent task.
That is Alex Duvall, who is Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, talking with us about the situation in Sudan, where there is now a power-sharing agreement in place after a brutal crackdown on the pro-democracy movement. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Well, the Trump administration's on-again, off-again operation to arrest thousands of members of undocumented migrant families is now set to begin on Sunday. NPR has learned that the raids will be conducted by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents over multiple days and are expected to take place in at least 10 major U.S. cities. President Trump said early last week that the roundups would come after the 4th of July holiday, but they were postponed after concerns within the immigration agency. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship spent some time hearing how, whether they're carried out or not, the threats of deportations are changing lives.
Most weekdays, Anna gets done cleaning houses around 4 and gets in her car. That's when she starts her second job, cruising the streets of Houston County, Georgia, on the lookout for the police. Anna asks we only use her first name. She tells people what she sees on a special smartphone app, and she's not the only one on the lookout. There are people patrolling places like Gwinnett County and Gainesville, Georgia, too. What they share is meant to keep people from being arrested and potentially deported while they're trying to get to and from work. When Trump became president of the United States, I decided I had to do something to help my people. Hanna says even the years when the Obama administration literally broke deportation records were more tranquil for undocumented immigrants than today. She says back then Obama's way with words papered over a lot of anxiety. But she says Trump's words have had the opposite effect, spreading fear. It's really hard because it's this thing where Trump is always in your head. So now she says even simple things, going to the grocery store, taking kids to school, can feel very high stakes.
Nuestra gente tiene miedo.
Anna says our people are afraid. And fear is keeping people from daily routines. That's clear when we stop at a mobile home park popular with undocumented immigrants. It's close enough to shopping, and you could walk if the roads weren't dangerous. Anna says many people are spending money they can barely afford on ride-sharing services like Uber, rather than drive and risk getting stopped by police. But families take care of each other, as one mother, a U.S. citizen, explains to me in front of the home she shares with her parents, who are undocumented. She says her mom and dad love what the U.S. has done for their kids, but today, fear has them housebound.
Bueno, ya tengo una niña.
I have a daughter, my sister's married, and we all have families and new lives. But we all live with the same fear because our parents have to be hidden. They can't leave the house. If they're not going out with us, they're not going out. Some, both inside and outside immigrant communities, say that for people who are just working and staying out of trouble, the president's threats mean nothing. It's people that already have deportation orders or criminal records who are in jeopardy. But that's cold comfort for people like the young man who just arrived in the recent flow of immigrants at the Mexican border. Now he and his dad have immigration court dates to keep, but no idea what Trump's words mean for them. We're just praying to God we get more time to stay here. In another part of the park, two boys, brothers, tear around on BMX bikes. Their mom is watching from the yard in front of their home. We're afraid, but more from the point of view of a mother, because sometimes they send you back to your home country and leave the kids behind. I ask about her sons. She says they feel it too. They're terrified to be home alone without their mom or dad. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
On Monday, a federal judge blocked the Trump administration's attempt to require pharmaceutical companies to include list prices, the actual prices of drugs, in their TV ads. The list price is negotiated by insurers, people with prescription coverage. Usually you never see it, only their copays. Nick Florco is the Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Nick, a lot of patient advocacy groups also wanted this rule. Why?
Well, their basic premise is that many patients do end up paying some form of what's related to the list price. So when you imagine, for example, a person that has insurance and has a high deductible, that list price actually does matter. They're paying the list price until they hit that deductible.
Yeah, but well, you know, in watching a TV ad, if I'm a consumer and I see that a medication maybe costs over $5,000, which many do, frankly, are most people really caring about that because they don't have to pay that?
Well, I mean, that's the point that the drug industry makes, right? It's that this will disincentivize people to talk to their doctor because they see a price, they're scared off, and they don't realize my insurance will cover most of that.
Yeah, you talked to a professor at Case Western Reserve who said this is a health policy through public humiliation. In other words, humiliate the drug companies in the ads by showing how much, you know, they're charging for these medications. But what did the judge say in the ruling?
So it's interesting. So the drug makers that sued, first of all, they sued saying that HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, doesn't have the authority to do this and that it violated their First Amendment rights. The judge didn't tackle that First Amendment issue. They just said the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't have the authority to require these disclosures.
So was the judge essentially kicking it back, saying change the law?
So he didn't say that explicitly, but it's a real possibility. This has already had some momentum in Congress. Senator Chuck Grassley already has a bill that would do this. And he told a group of reporters just after the ruling that he wanted to get that in a package of healthcare bills likely to move through the Senate later this year.
The industry itself has a voluntary policy, and some companies, including Johnson & Johnson, are revealing prices. Here's a TV ad that company released in March for the popular blood thinner, Xarelto. Let's listen.
I was just finishing a ride. I felt this awful pain in my chest. I had a PE blood.
And now at the end of the commercial, there is on the screen a list price of $488 a month. Is there a sense that consumers might react to that and say, well, that's, I'm not paying that, but that's kind of expensive. Maybe I should get an alternative?
I mean, there's certainly a concern. It's a real concern that patients won't talk to their doctor when they see this. So drug makers instead have decided to include a link in their ads where they can go to a website and they can get more nuanced information. For example, you could put in your insurance information and say, okay, I have this plan. This is how much this drug is likely to cost me, as opposed to that one price that might scare them off.
So this was a campaign promise from this president, but most administrations have wrestled with the high cost of drugs. What is the sense of how they might be brought down, if not, you know, shaming drug companies through putting them in TV ads, which a judge says they can't do?
Well, there's a lot of ideas out there. I mean, to be honest, it feels every day there's a new bill that's introduced in Congress to deal with the idea of prescription drugs. Democrats say that the number one way to bring down prescription drugs is to allow Medicare to just negotiate the prices. The Veterans Administration already does this. They say, you know, we're a huge purchaser of drugs. Let them directly negotiate and get the prices down. That's just one proposal, though. There's, like I alluded to earlier, a package of bills that's being worked on in the Senate currently to deal with prescription drugs. And there's a lot of ideas in there.
Nick Florco, Washington correspondent for STAT, the health and medicine publication. Nick, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This week, we're looking at how China is gaining influence with U.S. allies in Asia. We heard from Vietnam, where analyst Lei Hong Hiep told us Hanoi is finding itself in the middle of a new Cold War.
The U.S. and China are entering a new Cold War, and the two powers will expect Vietnam to take side.
We looked at Pakistan, where analyst Shamila Chaudhry told us Chinese economic investment has led to military cooperation as well.
Pakistani political insiders will tell us that, look, the U.S. wasn't offering us what we needed anymore, and China was knocking on our doors, so we're gladly taking their help.
Yesterday, we looked at the Philippines, where President Rodrigo Duterte is getting closer to China while maintaining a longstanding defense relationship with the U.S. So today, as we wrap up our series, let's check in on Indonesia. And joining us now is Evan Laksmana, who is a senior researcher with the Center for Strategic International Studies in Jakarta. Evan, how would you describe the relationship that Indonesia has with China right now?
I think to sum it up, I think it's full of ambivalence. I think on the political side, Indonesian politicians are always easily painted as a potential foreign lackey if they're seen as too close to China. But when it comes to foreign policy, we are also very much non-aligned, so we cannot be seen as too pro-China or too pro-US in that sense, but also because we're also dealing with a lot of bad historical and social legacy of violence against ethnic Chinese Indonesians over the past few decades. So being seen as this tough spot between pro-China, because we need it, its economic engagement, but also we cannot be seen as too close or we'll risk huge domestic backlash. So it's a very tricky position for the government to be in.
Well, and give us more of a sense of what you're talking about with the history between Indonesia and China.
So when it comes to the social elements, there's a long history in which ethnic Chinese Indonesians are perceived as a small minority but extremely wealthy. And I think that creates all kinds of political manipulation and resentment among the larger political elite. And up until, during the Cold War, we ended diplomatic relations with China from 1965 up until the 90s. So there was a long hiatus in which we don't have any ties with China, and which was only restored in the 90s. So I think right now we're just trying to re-engage China economically, but that's creating whole kinds of potential domestic backlash. And it's not even talking about the potential security concerns that Jakarta has with the South China Sea and all that.
Well, we'll get to the issues in the South China Sea, but first of all, how would you describe the Indonesian relationship with the United States right now?
I think with the U.S., it's always been up and down. With Obama, it was the up period. We had a framework for strategic partnership that's been growing and more developed. But I think with Trump, I think we're just hitting the point of ignorance in the sense that we're ignoring the rhetoric coming out of Washington. Yes, the U.S. is still an important part of our thinking, but it's no longer the most important player. And especially because I think for the past 20 years, the biggest question mark has always been, what will China's rise do to us? But right now, I think the biggest question mark is, what kind of scandal will we see coming out of Washington? So I think the sense of uncertainty that's coming out of Washington is making us harder to keep track, and we're just going to put the U.S. on the sidelines for now.
And when you talk about the strategic partnership with the United States, is that more military-based or economic?
The framework that Obama laid with the previous president, Yudhoyono, is broader. It has a people-to-people relationship framework, like scholarships, exchanges, mm-hmm. visits, and all that. And then there's the economic components, obviously, the business ties and investment, but also the political and security elements. So it's a comprehensive partnership across various government-to-government, as well as people-to-people ties.
Well, because Indonesia has the world's largest Muslim population, and it has been an important ally with the United States in terms of dealing with Islamic extremism.
Yeah, I think since 9/11, the security relationship revolves around both the a counterterrorism element as well as the military element. And that's something that's a bit harder to sort of restore, because in the 90s, the U.S. actually put a sanction on Indonesia for its alleged human rights abuses in East Timor. So the military-to-military ties were only slowly recovering by the mid-2010s or so. So I think that's still a slow progress. But I think the political engagement with the previous administration was not just about a counterterrorism, but it's also about how to promote religious pluralism, how to strengthen democratic capacity, and how to broaden the civil society space. So it's not just about terrorism or Islamic extremism.
Are there military ties between China and Indonesia?
There is. I think in the past few years, there's been much more frequent visits and exchanges. There's a small number of exercises for the army, particularly when it comes to the special forces. There's some small amount of defense technological cooperation, but that's very slow. Some small amount of arm purchases and a small number of education exchanges. But the scale of security and military ties between Indonesia and China are nothing compared to the scale of U.S. and Indonesia military ties that's been going on for a lot longer and much more deeper than any other country.
Okay, well, let's get to the issue with the South China Sea. Indonesia is planning to develop fishing grounds in order to push back against China's encroachment. Tell us about what the concerns are or what the conflict is there in the South China Sea.
So there's two separate sets of issues that tends to be conflated, I think, with regards to Indonesia and the South China Sea. One is the South China Sea disputes themselves, and in this particular case, the Spratly Islands. As far as the disputed water goes, Indonesia is not a claimant in the dispute between the other countries like Vietnam and Malaysia and China, for that matter. The second problem, I think, is with regards to maritime law enforcement, where Chinese fishermen are often caught within Indonesia's exclusive economic zones. So we're trying to respond to the encroachment with regards to maritime law enforcement, but because we have international law on our side and because we're not staking a claim in the Spratly disputes, we're not confronting China with regards to the South China Sea disputes. In fact, we're simply ignoring their claim because they haven't made their specific claims with regards to our waters, but they have been making claims with regards to the fishing rights. So I think the fishery centers, the stronger maritime law enforcement, that's part of our response to the encroachment into our exclusive economic zones.
One of the things that I found interesting is that because of the trade war with the United States, it's become more difficult for China to trade with the U.S., and they've been looking for other overseas opportunities to trade. And Indonesia has actually turned out to be one of the best opportunities. So have the economic ties increased between China and Indonesia because of the U.S. trade war?
I think right now in Southeast Asia, both Vietnam and Indonesia, I think, are sort of competing to sort of exploit or gain advantage from the trade war. So we're not the only one that other countries are looking at. China's focus has always been on like a transportation industry and tourism. So maybe on the industry side of things, there's been talks, but right now it's still focused on resource extraction. Manufacturing is something that sort of we're competing with Vietnam on that front. So we're not sure yet if we are actually going to benefit from the trade war. We're thinking about it and we're planning about it, but we haven't seen the material benefits just yet.
If we compare this to a game of tug of war, do you think that right now the Chinese side is pulling closer in their direction at the expense of the United States?
If it's a single issue tug of war and one rope, I think yes. China is probably about 60-70% ahead of the US. But of course, the problem is that it's not just a single rope, right? That there's multiple issues and multiple ropes being played here. So I think on the economic front, I think China is certainly doing more of the pulling than the US. But on the other front, like security, for example, I think it's still a long way to go before China takes over the US in that sense.
And of course, with the Belt and Road Initiative now, which China is investing in countries around the world, there are already some projects that are in the works. They haven't started yet, but they will start, and that will give China even more of an economic foothold in Indonesia.
Yes, I think if all of the commitments that are being discussed and planned under the Belt and Road Initiative between China and Indonesia are delivered, let's say, within the next 10 to 20 years, yes, I think China is set to be the most influential player in Indonesia.
That's Evan Laksmana, who is a senior researcher with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Jakarta, Indonesia, and a visiting fellow at the National Bureau of Asian Research in Seattle. Evan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And you can find our whole series on China's growing influence in Asia at hereandnow.org.
The All-Star Game is in the books, the American League beating the National League 4-3 in Cleveland, only two home runs, even though the sport itself is on a record pace for homers this season, which resumes tonight. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So there have been nearly 3,300 home runs already this season. I think I had one. And if they keep this up, there could be 6,600 homers, you know, if they break the record.
Yeah.
Some people think the ball is juiced. What do you think?
Well, I just think you have a sweet stroke, and that was a line drive, a BB out to right. So, is the ball juiced? What does juiced mean?
I have no idea.
Well, I'll tell you. Here, it depends what juiced means. The ball is different, and the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, will say that it's not intentional that the ball is different, but they've done a number of studies and they've found, for instance, the ball's drag coefficient is such that it has more carry. And a reason for that might be the laces are tighter because the people stitching them maybe just stitch them a little tighter. And this means the ball stays more compact after it's impacted. Anyway, it goes further. The commissioner of baseball is basically, he is not denying that the ball is different. He's just trying to kind of brush back the charge that it's intended to be different so that scoring goes up. And there's a great quote from him to tell you where baseball is. It's hand-stitched, where it's stored after it's made, where it's stored at the ballpark, who puts the mud on the ball, how much mud they put on the ball. It's really difficult to isolate a single cause, but we do think it's a drag issue. So you may be hearing that and saying, mud on the ball? Yeah. Baseball still packs the ball with mud, and one of his solutions is to make that more uniform.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I like what you did there, brush back. I heard
that.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, some people are saying, well, all we're seeing are home runs or strikeouts. Do the ratings or attendance reflect a disappointment with the home run season?
Only insofar as that home runs, an exciting event, come at the expense of balls in play, and they take more time. It takes more time to try to work a strikeout. The games are dragging on and on and on, to say nothing of players stepping out and adjusting their shin guards and stuff. So, yeah, long games have an impact, and ratings and attendance are suffering, and baseball knows it has a problem, but it is loath to do anything. I think these are two sort of semi-related problems. I also think that baseball is very, it's a very traditional sport, so that if you break with the way the game has always played, sometimes in basketball or football, that's exciting, you know, three-pointers and long touchdown passes. But in baseball, you don't want so much of a break. And like you said, I mean, last year, the Yankees set a record for 267 team home runs. This year, three teams are on pace to beat that.
Yeah, well, you mentioned basketball. The last time we spoke, it was about NBA free agency. At that time, we didn't know where Kawhi Leonard was going. We now know he's left the Toronto Raptors, the team he led to the NBA title, for the Los Angeles Clippers. So how has the free agency period reshaped the NBA?
I think it's totally remade it. I mean, coming into last year, the Golden State Warriors were the odds-on favorite and seen as, you know, all but unbeatable. It's not that that view was wrong. They had several horrible injuries in the finals. This year, you know, the Lakers are a great team. The Clippers are a great team. Some teams that don't play in one arena, the Staples Center, are considered good teams. I think it's totally remade it. And Kawhi's presence, along with the newly acquired Paul George on the Clippers, is a huge, huge difference.
Okay. Look, before we go, we want to just remember Jim Bouton, the former major league pitcher who really opened the window for people about professional baseball with his book Ball 4 in 1970, a rollicking tale. But it was said that, you know, he was banned from the Yankees, didn't go back to old-timers games, there was public pressure. Of course, he was with other teams. Seattle comes to mind. But he just seemed like a unique character in baseball. Your thoughts?
Yes, this is a guy with a 63-64 lifetime record. So it's nothing that he did on the field that makes us remember him. He wrote this tell-all memoir that, by the way, in today's sensibilities would maybe not fly, a lot of the sexual antics, but you know, this was part of the Animal House trend of just throwing off the old shackles. And that's what he did. And yeah, he was quite clearly blackballed from the game. He made a small comeback for the Braves later in his career. He also had arm injuries, so that's part of it. Mm. The book will be remembered and will be his legacy. But if you're saying, oh, how did Jim Bouton ever survive? Certain members of your audience, this might resonate with. He's the co-inventor of Big League Chew.
Absolutely.
That chewing gum. He made a lot of money off of that.
Well, he also, I mean, he became a broadcaster for a while. They made a small series from his book. He starred in a film. He was. Yes. I played catch with him once. I mean, he just was one of those people who was really out there. And by the way, an ex-wife, he wrote Ball 4, kind of an expose of baseball. His ex-wife wrote a book about him, an expose of living with kind of him. And he said, you know what? She's right. Everything she said. So he's a real character. We remember Jim Bouton. He was 80. He died at his home in the Berkshires. Here's the last line of his book, Ball 4. You see, he wrote, you spend a good piece of your life gripping a baseball, and in the end, it turns out that it was the other way around all the time. Baseball gripping him. Jim Bouton. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. It's a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.